When I first started preaching, I was impressed with a statement that I found in Proverbs, the 25th chapter. And at the time, I was reading almost exclusively from the King James translation. In Proverbs 25 at verse 16, the New International Translation says, "If you find honey, eat just enough. Too much of it and you'll vomit." Then in verse 27, the King James Translation is very different than the New International Translation. The King James Translation says in verse 27, "It's not good to eat too much honey, so to seek one's own glory is not glory." I spent some time working as an ambulance attendant, an EMT, in Oregon when I was preaching in Brookings. And one of the things that we did was we carried honey in the ambulance, because honey is great. If you come up on someone that looks like they're having a seizure, you can rub some honey inside their lip. And if it's a diabetic problem, the honey will help to resolve the diabetic problem. And if it's just about anything else, the honey won't hurt you. Honey's great stuff. But too much of it will, in fact, make you pretty sick. It's not a pleasant experience. So I was thinking about all of those things as I started thinking about what it's like in the kingdom and the way that kingdom people view themselves. And it's a very different way of looking at themselves. We start out our lives as little babies, and excuse me, for the most part, we're pretty self-absorbed when we're little babies. And that's the way that it should be, because we really can't take care of ourselves. We have to recruit someone to take care of our needs. So we're pretty much self-absorbed. But as we mature, hopefully we move away from a sense of absolute self-absorption to an awareness of what's going on around us and an awareness of the needs that other people have. Popular society, modern society, has a view of self that I think is largely based on a failure to mature from this necessary self-centeredness. Contemporary society seems to be defined by a commitment to what most people would call personal autonomy. That sounds well and good, but what it means is that autonomous people direct their own lives without things being imposed upon them by any force outside of their own will. Popular society would suggest that no outside factor that you have not freely chosen should affect your decisions. Excuse me. People would be free to define themselves as it suits them. And it's easy to see when we think about what's happening in marriage and the influence of this autonomous self, such that there is no relationship in marriage that constrains the way that we behave. And when the marriage no longer suits the way that we want to behave, then we're free to make a different decision. This notion of autonomy suggests that our choices have to be made without the influence of any imposed habits, any human reason, any education, any social pressure, any legal pressure, any cultural expectations, any kind of external demand. We make all of our own decisions based solely on what we want. Our choices spring from within us. And in its extreme forms, it would suggest that anything else is oppression. Only the parts of our identity that are traceable to our choice are worthy of any concern and any respect. So, in the extreme view, constraints that are opposed by gender have to be removed. And the only way that you can do that is to make gender fluid and something that we choose. You might be a man who chooses to identify as a woman. That's the natural outcome of the autonomous self. We see it in the responsibilities that are involved in procreation. Locke talked about the act of begetting. And because we beget children, then certain constraints are imposed upon us by the act of begetting. But we've lost sight of that. Bringing a fetus to life can become a matter of choice, not a matter of constraints that are exercised on our behaviors. And when we make choices that way, and I understand that I'm describing the extreme, but it's the logical outcome of the argument that many people have made about the autonomous self. We begin to make choices that are based exclusively on selfishness. Autonomous choices arise from my desire, from my conception of what will make me happy, from my arbitrary will. And furthermore, it would suggest that human dignity rests on society's willingness to accept, or at least not condemn, autonomous efforts to restructure our lives, to restructure anything that stands in the way of my life choices. And contemporary liberal thought or progressive thought demands public financial support so that individuals will be free to choose regardless of economic limitations or any kind of consequences. I think that's a mistake. But I think it's a mistake not because I think it's a mistake, but because of biblical information. So let's look at the biblical information about the way that a person who is a kingdom person views himself. Recognizing legitimate personal needs is warranted. And biblically, we're supposed to recognize our needs. We do have a need to be valued by others, and we need to love ourselves. Notice how much it underpins some of the commandments that are given. Look at Ephesians, the fifth chapter, at verse 29. The apostle says, husbands ought to love their wives, and then get this, as their own bodies. He who loves his wife loves himself. After all, no one ever hated their own body, but they feed and care for their body just as Christ does the church. We're members of his body. For this reason, a man will leave his father and mother and be united to his wife, and the two will become one flesh. This is a profound mystery. I'm talking about Christ and the church. However, this is the bottom line. Each of you must also love his wife as he loves himself, and the wife must respect her husband. In the marriage relationship, there are certain things that are commanded, but they're commanded on the basis of, or because they are like, the way that we're loving ourselves. Some people think that they must loathe themselves, that they must hate themselves. Monasticism is in some ways based on the principle that I beat down my body. I mistreat my body. But self-loathing, because it's defeating, ignores the love of self as the basis for the love of others. Mark the 12th chapter, a passage that we have been looking at over and over again because it's where Jesus talks about the way that kingdom people operate. Mark the 12th chapter, beginning at verse 28, one of the teachers of the law, he was a Jew, came and heard Jesus having a discussion with two people. So he heard them debating. Noticing that Jesus had given them a good answer, this teacher of the law then asked Jesus this question: of all the commandments, which is the most important? The most important one, answered Jesus, is this: hear, O Israel, the Lord our God is one. Love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, with all your mind, and with all your strength. The second is this: love your neighbor as yourself. There's no commandment greater than these. Matthew, the 7th chapter in the Sermon on the Mount, passage that everybody tends to know. Jesus said, in everything, do to others what you would have them do to you. This sums up the Law and the Prophets. A great deal of physical and emotional harm is inflicted by those who hate themselves on other people, not just themselves, but it's inflicted on other people. To recognize that we're all creatures made by God, I am made by God, and you are made by God in His image. And the value that that implies is really the basis for the kingdom. God don't make no junk. He didn't make me junk, and He didn't make you junk. But I have to understand that. It's when the interest in the self becomes an inordinate interest, or an interest in self that's beyond what's warranted, that it becomes arrogance, and it becomes just pomposity. And it arises generally from two sources. Number one could be that you genuinely feel that you're superior to other men and women. It's the person who genuinely thinks he's the smartest person in the room. And sometimes in a kind of a twisted sort of way, it can be an overcompensation for feelings of inadequacy. The arrogant person, you have to understand, resents anything or anyone who draws attention away from them. So the Bible describes what an inordinate view of self, or an inappropriate view of self, produces. In Philippians, the 2nd chapter, at verse 3, this is what the apostle writes: therefore, if any of you have any encouragement from being united with Christ, if there's any comfort from His love, if there's any common sharing in the Spirit, if there's any tenderness and compassion, then make my joy complete by being like-minded, having the same love, being one in spirit and in mind. Do nothing out of selfish ambition or vain conceit. That's the opposite. Rather, in humility, value others above yourselves, not looking to your own interests, but each of you to the interests of others. This word that's translated conceit, according to Vine, comes from two Greek words that are compounded into one. The first one designates vanity or emptiness, and the second one is glory. So it's empty glory. It's like Proverbs, the 25th chapter at verse 27. So for a man to seek his own glory is not glory. The adjective form of this word is seen in Galatians, the 5th chapter at verse 26, and it has the same kind of meaning. The second thing that happens when we have an inappropriate view of self is we get caught up in pride. In the King James translation, a translation that we're much more familiar with, this is the way Romans 1, beginning at about verse 28, reads. Even as they did not like to retain God in their knowledge, God gave them over to a reprobate mind. So God let them go. And in their reprobate mind, they did those things which are not convenient. That's an interesting word. They do things that are not convenient. It means things that are not good for themselves, and they recognize that it's not good for themselves. That's the meth tweaker who continues to tweak meth, even though he knows it's not good for him. He says, being filled with all unrighteousness and fornication and wickedness and covetousness and maliciousness, full of envy, murder, debate, deceit, malignity, whisperers, backbiters, haters of God, despiteful, here's the word, proud. That's what causes all of this. They're boasters, they're inventors of evil things, they're disobedient to parents, without understanding, covenant breakers. Why break covenants? Because I changed my mind. They have no natural affection. They are implacable, unmerciful, who, knowing the judgment of God, that they which commit such things are worthy of death, not only do the same, but have pleasure in them that do them. According to Vine, proud has the meaning of showing oneself above others. And the word in the Greek that's translated proud, again, it's a compound word. The first part of the word means over, and the second part of the word means appearing. So it's appearing over someone. 2 Timothy, the 3rd chapter, at verse 2. Again, the apostle is describing what happens when people leave God. He says, mark this. There will be terrible times in the last days. People will be lovers of themselves, lovers of money, boastful, proud, abusive, disobedient to their parents, ungrateful, unholy, without love, unforgiving, slanderous, without self-control, brutal, not lovers of the good, treacherous, rash, conceited, lovers of pleasure more than lovers of God. They have a form of godliness, but they deny its power. Now, what's really interesting is that Paul tells Timothy this exists even among Christians. There are people who will want to bring this into the kingdom, but it doesn't belong there. It can't be there. The apostle says, in conclusion, have nothing to do with those people. It's contrasted with the idea of humility in 1 Peter, the 5th chapter, and at verse 5. Interesting passage. He says, in the same way, you who are younger, submit yourselves to your elders, all of you, younger, elders, women, men, everyone, clothe yourselves with humility towards one another, because God opposes the proud, but shows favor to the humble. It can't be that way in the kingdom. 1 Timothy 3 at verse 6 is a really interesting passage. It's the Apostle Paul giving instructions to Timothy about appointing elders and what kind of men ought to be appointed elders. At verse 6, he says, he must not be a recent convert, or he may become conceited and fall under the same judgment as the devil. This word, become conceited, that's an interesting word. It means to be wrapped up in smoke. Isn't that a strange way to describe conceit? But when you think about it this way, it makes sense. One's vision, according to Vine, becomes obscured by self-importance. 1 Corinthians, the 4th chapter, beginning at verse 18. The apostle says, some of you have become arrogant, as if I were not coming to you. But I will come very soon, if the Lord is willing. And then I'll find out not only how arrogant these people are talking, but what power they have. You know, it's not that way in the kingdom, but there are people who try to bring it into the kingdom. So how do you keep yourself in perspective? How do you maintain a proper view of self? Well, Philippians, the 2nd chapter, verse 4, do nothing out of selfish ambition or vain conceit. In humility, value others above yourselves, not looking to your own interest, but each of you to the interest of others. Genuine love for others causes us to use our resources for their good, because we understand we're stewards of what God has given us. We're not intended to be just hoarders of the blessings that God gives to us. Look at the way that the Apostle Paul described himself in 2 Corinthians, the 12th chapter, and beginning at verse 15. He says, I will very gladly spend for you everything I have and expend myself as well. You see that in a good marriage relationship. A husband will do everything for his wife. His resources are his so that he can care for her, not so that he can hoard it for himself. Now, we understand what our motivation for the caring for the needs of another really are. It's because we want to be like God, and God cares for other people. The sad fact is that if you live that way, a lot of people won't appreciate it. They won't be able to understand it. Think back to the Apostle Paul, 2 Corinthians, the 12th chapter, verse 15, where we were just reading. I will gladly spend for you everything I have and expend myself as well. If I love you more, will you love me less? But you know, that's the way it is. People didn't understand Jesus either. Jesus came to the earth, gave everything, and rather than appreciated it, we killed him. Understanding God's selfless love, it demands our effort. And we, if we're going to be in the kingdom, have to be like God. The fact is that we're flawed, fallible human beings with little reason to think that the universe revolves around us. We struggle with sin and temptation. We battle ignorance. We fail those that are around us through callous indifference or just because we're unintentionally distracted. We need God's grace and mercy and forgiveness, and we're sons of God. That makes us important people. And if we understand that, we can be in the kingdom. I know that this is a hard thing for people that are not part of the kingdom to understand. And I know that if you behave this way around people in the world, sometimes they'll think you're crazy. They will not understand. But I think that's the best way to be, in spite of the fact that people don't understand. If you want to be that kind of person, then put on Jesus. We'll help you do that. Put him on in baptism, and we'll live together with you, and we will help you in any way that we can. You know, I said we're all fallible people and we fail. But the Apostle John said, if we ask for God's forgiveness, he'll give it. We repent, we turn from the way that we mistakenly were behaving, and we turn back to God. We forsake our sin and we return to him. And in prayer, ask for his forgiveness. He's promised he would give it. It's a wonderful thing to think about self and how we use ourselves in the service of others because we're in the kingdom. Mark's going to lead us in our thoughts about the Lord's Supper. The ultimate picture of Jesus and the kind of understanding that he had of himself.